I want to tell you about a podcast you should check out. It's called Understood Explains. This season of the show is hosted by teacher and special education expert Juliana Urtube, and it's all about how to navigate individual education plans, also known as IEPs. The latest season of Understood Explains covers topics like how to tell if your child needs an IEP, and it busts common myths about special education. As a parent myself of a child who's had an IEP since kindergarten and he's now a 10th grader, I know how confusing, overwhelming, frustrating, sometimes daunting the whole process can be. I checked out an episode of Understood Explains called The Difference Between IEPs and 504 Plans. And what I love about it is how easily Juliana explains everything. She answers common questions that probably every parent or caregiver has. She dispels myths and is concise and to the point. To listen to Understood Explains, search for Understood Explains in your podcast app. That's Understood Explains. And there's a direct link in the show notes if you need it.
This is the Your Kick-Ass Life podcast with Andrea Owen, a no BS guide to self-help and badassery. Because ladies, let's face it, life's too short for it to not kick ass. And here's your host, the girl who serves it up straight with a side of crazy, Andrea Owen.
This is the Your Kick-Ass Life podcast, episode number 72. All links and resources you hear in this podcast can be found by going to yourkickasslife.com/72. Hey, Ass Kickers. Welcome to another special edition of the Your Kick-Ass Life podcast. And I've been sitting here just avoiding hitting record, palm sweating, feeling like I'm going to throw up. And this is, I feel like, wasn't it like in the 80s in those shows that we used to love to watch, like Family Ties and Growing Pains, where when they were going to talk about something like kind of heavy, heavy topic, they were like, on today's special edition of Family Ties, like, you know, it was like adult content or something like that. Like, I feel like that's how I should preface this episode. And this is an episode that I wanted to write as a blog post and a podcast episode. And if you don't know already, if you're a subscriber to my podcast, anytime I do a solo podcast, the whole, for not all of them, I just started doing this maybe a couple months ago, but they are written out pretty much in their entirety on my blog. And so if you wanted to share it that way, if you wanted to go back and read it, you're more than welcome to do that. On my podcast, I tend to kind of like go off on extra tangents, so you have that advantage. And normally I have like a space in this podcast where I tell you something funny that's going on in my life, and I probably do have some funny things to tell you, but I'm kind of like don't really feel like getting into it right now. So I think I'm just going to kind of jump in and start telling the story. And I feel like, you know, it's interesting. Every time I come out, I think the last time that I came out with something big and told my story was when I had been sober for a year. So it was 2012. And I came out with my story and I didn't do a podcast episode about it. I just wrote it. And it's an entirely different thing to actually speak the words. For me, writing, there's an element of still being able to hide. You know, because like I type it out and then I put it out into the world and then I can just like shut down the internet and not read any of the comments. But there's something about actually telling the story into my microphone here that makes it all the very more real. And I think that I'm telling you all of this not to waste time. Well, maybe partly a little bit, but to really emphasize that at the end of the day, you know, it's easy for me to sit here and tell you all the wisdom that I have had over the healing of my life over the last several years and the things that I teach and preach and all of those things. But it's a whole nother when I come out with a story and tell you my truth. And it's interesting because, I don't know, someone told me a long time ago, and I've always taken this advice to heart about not coming out with stories to your audience, you know, as an online business owner and at being in the personal development world, don't come out with stories that you're still truly in the process of and that are still really raw. And that's why I waited an entire year to tell you all about my story about getting sober. Like I needed to go through through some good recovery and I needed to process and digest a lot of it. And it's really the same thing with this. The story I'm about to tell you is really like what happened in the span of about, I don't know, 11 or 12 years. And I'm through it. I'm 40 now. 40, yes. I haven't turned 41 yet. But I think it's still one of those things that to tell the story, you know, I can tell it to my really close friends and my compassionate witnesses, the people that have earned the right to hear their story. But to tell it at a public forum like this, I think there's still that voice that comes in and is like, you probably shouldn't tell everybody this. They're probably going to think you're a big giant loser. And or what will they think? And the truth is that all of us have a painful story. You listening to this right now have a story that if I heard it, it might bring me to my knees. And if other people heard it, you know, same thing. But the more we abandoned our stories and keep them locked up, the more painful they are, really. And those stories help absolutely no one. And that's just absolutely shitty. And I also know for sure that we can't bury our stories alive and expect them to die. They don't. Brené teaches us that we can't go through life orphaning parts of ourselves. Bless you. That was my dog sneezing. We can't go through life orphaning parts of ourselves in order to try to create this persona that we think we need to be. And there's still a little tiny voice inside me that wants to do that and wants to create this perfect persona. And that simply is not who I am. And that simply is really not honoring my value around courage and my value around authenticity. It really just feels like shit to do that. I absolutely feel lucky to get to share my stories here and sometimes scared, but still very lucky. So thank you for allowing me to do so. Part of the reason that I wanted to come out with this story is I got this email years ago from an ass kicker. This was back, I think probably even before I had my podcast. And she said, when I first heard from you, you seemed like a perky, outgoing blonde. And these are all great things, but I must admit, when looking at you, we might think, oh, she's never been through anything. Yeah, she has great things to say, but does she know what this is like? And then upon listening further, I learned your earlier life actually very much mirrors my own. It was not only comforting, but also a lesson learned about first impressions. And I thank you for saying that. And I love honesty like that. And a lot of you already know my story about when in 2006, my husband had an affair with our neighbor and got her pregnant. And then I got involved quickly in another relationship that was actually worse than that one. And that really is what... that was my rock bottom. Me getting sober wasn't my rock bottom at all. Getting sober was kind of like, oh shit, like I can't drink anymore. It was different than a lot of people, but me losing my relationships and just like losing myself and realizing all of that, that was definitely my rock bottom. So I wanted to tell this story and talk to you about what happened and how I behaved in my 20s. And I do kind of think for many of us, like our 20s is our decade for us to just like screw up and be a little crazy, whatever that definition is for you. Mine was no different. But I think it really was me falling down over and over again and then finally taking responsibility, looking at everything and working on healing. And so here it begins. Generally speaking, I had a great childhood. My parents were loving and funny and generous with their affection to me and to each other. And their marriage fell apart while I was in high school. I didn't know it when it was actually happening. But my mom left soon after I graduated from high school. And shortly after that, I sat in a therapist's office who actually ended up being my therapist for 20 years on and off. She had also seen my parents for marriage counseling, and she said to me in her office, I'll never forget it. She said, your parents don't really show their emotions very much. And I don't remember exactly what I said to her in response, but I distinctly remember thinking and being confused as to, like, was she implying that there was like another way for families to be, like other families actually show their emotions to each other and like talked about things? Because I certainly didn't know any other way. Like, I really did not know that another way existed. I hadn't even fathomed it. We basically had one emotion in our house, and that was happy. And that was what I saw all the time. If you had any others, it was clear to me the message was you did it alone and you did it behind closed doors. That's just how it was. There was little, if any, element of vulnerability. So I didn't know how to talk about emotions. I didn't know how to be with my emotions. So I certainly didn't know how to be with anybody else's emotions. And really what ended up happening is that emotions and feelings scared the shit out of me. And this isn't, you know, I want to say quickly, this isn't to blame and shame my parents. They didn't know any other way. But how were they supposed to parent when they really were never introduced to any kind of personal development? It like kind of really wasn't quite a thing in the 1970s when I was born. So I don't blame them absolutely at all. And I've actually had conversations with my parents about this and how I parent differently now, and it's all good. But I'd heard people, you know, growing up, like I'd heard people talking about dealing with quote unquote feelings and emotions. And I wasn't sure what that was. To me, dealing with feelings meant the goal was to get over them. Like that was the end goal, and to just get past them. So I thought, I made up that I needed to be stronger. I needed to buck up. I needed a soldier on. I needed to lock and load. I was like a hoarder of feelings. I'd find a spot way back, like in the dark closet of my mind, to stuff it where I wouldn't have to see it every day, but it never actually went away. It was never digested, never processed, seen, or felt. It just stayed there festering. Remember when I said, like, trying to bury your emotions alive and hoping that they die? Like, I really, you know, unconsciously, like, thought that that's what I was doing and thought that would work. And unfortunately, out of sight, out of mind doesn't work with feelings. I carried them around day after day, year after year, and they manifested outwardly as anger and blame. So I lashed out. And this is like more so like in my late teens and 20s, I engaged in behaviors that never felt right and made me question who I was. And the biggest thing I did over the course of all those years, like the underlying theme was that I hid. I was hiding from everything and from everyone. I was hiding from the world, really. Because to me, it was like, if the world saw who I really was, translation, if the world saw that I actually had feelings and fears and shame and all of those things, then no one would want, I would be rejected. Like that's really like underneath it all what I was feeling. I was terrified to be seen, but yet it was the very thing that I wanted so badly. So it was like this horrible dichotomy. Between the ages of 17 and 19, I had three significantly traumatic events happen, two of which I will tell you about. Trying to find the perfect gift for someone special in your life, maybe for Mother's Day, but feeling overwhelmed? Finding a unique gift that they'll love, that's personal and that they won't already have, can be the ultimate challenge. That's why I'm so excited I've discovered Songfinch. It's an amazing, thoughtful gift, and it's easy and fun to make. Songfinch lets you create an original radio-quality song inspired by your own life and the people you love. It's completely unique, personal, and lasts forever. I had Songfinch make me a song about my dad, which was a gift to myself. This was such a personal song for me, and I was a little skeptical the artist could capture the emotion I wanted. But during the process, they have you share some personal details about your relationship with the person you're creating the song for. Then Songfinch musician of your choice, you get to pick based on samples they have, will write, record, and produce your original song in just 4 to 7 days. I love my song so much. I was so emotional when I listened to it. I had no changes. It's perfect. Whether your song is for Father's Day, an upcoming graduation, wedding, or anniversary, or even just a gift to show your loved one how much you care, start your song now to lock in one of Songfinch's top artists. For a limited time, Songfinch is letting our listeners upload their song to Spotify for free, so you and the lucky person you gift it to can listen to it anywhere, anytime. Go to songfinch.com/noise and start your song. After you purchase, you'll be prompted to add Spotify streaming for your original song for free, a $50 value. Again, my URL is songfinch.com/noise. Don't forget to share your song with us too. songfinch.com/noise. There's definitely been times in my life where my paycheck ran out before I got paid again, and I wish I could have accessed my next paycheck a few days before I was due to get it. Well, what if I told you that can happen with Earnin? Earnin is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day or up to $750 per pay period. Just download the Earnin app and verify your paycheck. Then access up to $100 a day as you work and leave an optional tip. Any money you access plus tips are automatically repaid from your next paycheck. You can use Earnin for anything you need to, therapy visits, rent, or even extra self-help books. Make Earnin a part of your financial routine and join Earnin's over 3.5 million customers who say things like, "When I think about Earnin, I think about financial stability and security. It gives me a lot of peace of mind." Download Earnin today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the Earnin app, type in Noise under podcast when you sign up. It really helps the show. Noise under podcast. Subject to your available earnings, location, daily max, and pay period max. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Earnin is a financial technology company, not a bank. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank and Trust, member FDIC. So one of those was when my parents got divorced the summer after I graduated high school. And again, it completely surprised me. I had no idea that their marriage was even falling apart. I have half siblings from both of my parents were married previously, and they are older than I was, and they were long out of the house. They were out of the house by the time I was in kindergarten, all of them. And I was close with my sister, but one out of my four half siblings, but she's 12 years my senior. I adore her. My father is her stepfather, was her stepfather. And so it was really a lonely time. I didn't have anybody really to share in that grief, or even really just to talk about it. And of course, like in my therapist's office, what's funny is it's kind of like funny, not funny, is that one of my goals in therapy when I started seeing her when I was 18 was to not cry. I didn't want to cry in front of her. I wanted to just be strong. And then the summer after my parents got divorced, I was date raped. And regarding the date rape, for 20 years, I blamed myself, and even had a hard time all those years saying that it was actual date rape. What happened was I was drunk. This guy was not my boyfriend. I told myself I shouldn't have been there. I shouldn't have been making out with him in the first place. I should have tried to physically push him off me instead of just saying no over and over again, over and over and over again. I shouldn't have just given in like I did just in order to get it over with. I shouldn't have been worried that he would call me a tease or a prude. I shouldn't have. I kept that story locked inside me for 20 years, and I pushed it back into that back closet of my mind and convinced myself, like thoroughly convinced myself, that it was not a big deal. I told myself it happens all the time on college campuses. It happens all the time at parties. Why should I feel anything about this? People have real problems. Mine was absolutely not worthy of even giving a second thought to, let alone telling anyone my story. And that's really, like, in a nutshell, what I convinced myself of, and the story that I told myself for two decades. And then in the summer of 2014, when I went to Texas to undergo training with Brené Brown and her senior faculty on shame and vulnerability, guess what story came out like projectile vomit? That story of what happened. And really looking back on it, and what I uncovered was that when that happened, I felt like I had no voice. When that happened, I felt like I didn't matter. I felt powerless. I felt 100% at fault and told myself I should have known better. And I think what was really happening is that I thought he was cute and funny, and I wanted him to like me and pay attention to me. And I convinced myself that I got what I deserved. Really, you know, it wasn't until I told my story the summer before last to, again, people that I love and trusted, was I able to release a lot of that shame around it. But it still is not an easy story to tell. And I was 19 when that happened. And I had just turned 19. And looking back and connecting the dots, I can see that what happened that summer, and it was kind of coming, but what happened that summer was the straw that broke the camel's back as I entered the decade of my 20s. And just a couple of things that happened too was that I stopped writing, which had been my favorite creative outlet as a child, even, and as a teenager. I wrote a lot. I completely stopped when that happened. I started to engage basically in three addictive behaviors, and they were codependency, love addiction, and an eating disorder. And so I'm going to tell you what each of those looked like, and along with it, now what I see as to why I was engaging this way. And my hope really is, I'm not just telling the story for the sake of telling the story, just because I like to hear myself talk. This is, again, painful for me to like rip this Band-Aid off and tell the story in this much depth. My hope is that any of you listening will look at some of the things that happened in your past and maybe try to connect some of the dots as to why you behaved the way that you did, or maybe you're still behaving this way. And I want, before I start telling you the way that I used to be, this is not for you to say like, oh my God, I act this way, and then have your inner critic come in and beat you yourself up. And I think awareness is such a huge key factor here, and there might be a little bit of an element of, oh shit. But I invite you to really practice self-compassion. And for me, I hadn't learned that yet. Like when I started to come out of all of this and realize how I had been behaving, I had so much shame around that. And I was just so, like, I could not believe that I had behaved that way. And when I was in it, I knew it too. But like when I really started to like become conscious of my, into my personal development journey, it was just simply painful for me to look at. And so I had to do real work around that, around being compassionate to the girl that I was in my 20s, because I was definitely lost. I was so incredibly lost. So that being said, let's start with codependence. For me, codependence manifested mostly as control. I wanted everyone to behave like I wanted them to. I believed with all of my heart and soul that if that could happen, that would solve all of my problems and theirs too. So it was like a bonus for them. Melody Beattie, who is she's like kind of like the godmother in the recovery of codependence, describes codependence as one who has let another person's behavior affect him or her, and who is obsessed with controlling that person's behavior. For me, I stayed in a relationship with someone that I had outgrown around the time I was 18. This is my former husband. We started dating when I was 17. He was not interested, and I'm not making him wrong for this. Like, he just simply was not interested in settling down. Like, my God, he was 19 and 20 himself. He wasn't interested in settling down and being in a serious monogamous adult relationship. But at the same time, he wasn't ready to let me go. So it made for an interesting time together. I became obsessed with changing him and fixing him and fixing us, although I was not interested in fixing me. I read somewhere that codependency is a way to get your needs met that doesn't ever get your needs met. And I did this essentially for 13 years in my relationship with him. I didn't trust my own feelings or intuition. I micromanaged like it was my job. I people pleased. I felt insecure and guilty when people gave me things or complimented me. I wholeheartedly believed other people were responsible for me and my happiness as well. And at the same time, I felt like they were making me crazy. I was angry most of the time. I felt victimized and unappreciated for all of my efforts in trying to fix everyone. And compliments and appreciation and praise were the things I wanted desperately. But when I got them, I rejected them because I felt unworthy of it. And it was the same with intimacy. It was something I deeply craved, but at the same time, I was terrified of it. And I really didn't know what it looked like or felt like. And I thought that I had it, but it was really a desperate, false sort of intimacy. I was constantly afraid of making mistakes. Perfectionism was my middle name. I had some violent temper outbursts, and I had also lost faith in God. It was a dark time, and I kept it all very, very hidden, just how much I was suffering. My eating disorder was something I went back and forth with, and for a long time, I would never have admitted that I had an eating disorder, because of what we saw in the media was definitely not what I was engaging in. What I found out later is that I had something called eating disorder not otherwise specified, also known as EDNOS. I've written about that long, long, long time ago on my blog. But it started with poor body image around the age of 11. I wrote in my Hello Kitty diary, which I still have to this day. I wrote in there that I thought I was fat. I was 11, so I assume that was around the time I just started to go through puberty. And in my diary, I also wrote that I had told my mom that I thought I was fat, and I said in my diary, and she just told me I was average. And that was pretty much the extent of the conversation that my mother and I had around that. When I was 18, a modeling photographer told me I needed to lose 10 pounds if I ever wanted to be even considered modeling. And I was between a size 1 and a size 3. I was 26 when I decided. It was the first time I actually decided to take action and lose weight. I had gained a little bit of weight from my natural size, not very much, but just enough to overhear my boyfriend's friend say quietly, he didn't know that I could hear him, Andrea's ass is getting big. And that made the decision for me. And I was like, okay, I'll just lose 10 pounds easily. And I restricted calories. I exercised way too much. And I also purged. And then when I lost those 10 pounds, it was so easy that I decided to lose 10 more. And at that time, I think I was around 25 or 26, and I was probably at the height of my codependency as well. And I was running on empty, emotionally, mentally, physically. And eventually, I slowly gained that weight back and stopped those behaviors for a couple of years. But for me, when my life was in big turmoil, and mostly like when my relationship was in really big turmoil, my eating disorder came to the forefront of my life. I felt like it was the only thing that I could control, because I could not control him as much as I tried, but food and exercise and my weight and the size of my jeans was something that I could. And then there was love addiction. And I think that love addiction is one of those things that, I don't know, not a lot of people talk about that. And what's funny, and again, kind of like a funny, not funny, when I, the relationship that I was in after my husband, he went to rehab and I went with him. If anyone's ever had someone in an inpatient treatment center, they have like family week, or sometimes it's a weekend, or they do something where they invite families and loved ones to have like group therapy and do exercises and things like that. And that's really when it came to my attention that I was a love addict. And I knew that I was codependent. My therapist had told me that, but I hadn't been completely forthright with my therapist. Had I been forthright with her, she would have been like, "Oh, honey, we have some conversations to have." But I wasn't completely honest with her. So how would she have known? And oh my God, where do I even begin to talk about this? And this one really truly is the hardest one for me to talk about, because of the other people that were involved. So again, intimacy was the thing that I craved the most, but it was also the thing I feared absolutely the most. And so I was in kind of a shit pickle, right? I confused sex and the rush of a brand new relationship with love. I wouldn't be faithful in my relationships because I was so busy flirting and chasing men and hooking up with them in order to get that need met. And sometimes I had sex with them and sometimes I didn't. And when I didn't, I felt like that was some kind of victory to myself. Like I was okay as long as I didn't sleep with them, you know, and I had created these markers and criteria to what was okay and what wasn't. And I can honestly look back now and say that I used men to get what I wanted. And what I wanted was validation, love, and connection. And the kind of crazy thing was that I wasn't getting any of that, but I thought that I was. And I would feel good for a little while, and then the guilt and shame, oh my God, the shame, would come flooding in the next morning and I'd feel terrible about myself as a human being. So what would I do? I'd search for a new guy to chew up and spit out. And I left a trail of destruction in my love addiction, mostly with myself.
I'm Margaret.
And I'm Amy.
And together we host the podcast, What Fresh Hell? Laughing in the Face of Motherhood.
Margaret, I would say you're sort of a where are my keys kind of mom.
Correct. Sometimes a where are my kids kind of mom. While you're, Amy, more of a we were supposed to leave 35 seconds ago, mom.
I mean, touche. In each episode of What Fresh Hell, we come at a topic from our usually completely opposite perspectives. I bring the research.
And I bring kind of the gimlet eye. Like, is that research really going to work, people?
And almost 10 million downloads later, we're still laughing.
We also talk to experts in the parenting field, plus parents with stories we can all learn from.
We make each other laugh, we challenge each other's assumptions, and we have what we think is the best parenting community on the internet.
Check out What Fresh Hell, Laughing in the Face of Motherhood, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Well, hey there, busy mama. Are you looking for ways to make your life easier, your home less chaotic, and at the same time, add more joy to your life? My name is Deanna Yates, and I'm the host of Wanna Be Clutter-Free, a podcast all about letting go of the stuff we don't need in our lives so that we can focus on what truly matters. Don't worry, I'm not going to tell you to throw it all away or make you feel guilty about keeping something you love, no matter how many other people don't quite understand it. But I will give you practical and, more importantly, actionable advice so that you can make progress right away. And you won't just hear it from me. There are amazing guests, too. It's like having your bestie in your pocket, telling you it's okay to let go of the things that are not serving you and your family in a totally non-judgmental way. So join me over on the podcast where we can work on progress over perfection for those of us that want to be clutter-free.
My identity at that time was absolutely wrapped up in my appearance. So the more attention I got from men, the better I felt, the better I thought I felt. And some of the time I didn't even like them. It didn't really matter. It was the chase. It was the rush. I would walk into a club. I mean, this was going on like in my early 20s. So I'd walk into a club and scan the crowd for someone attractive, and the game began, and the cycle just kept starting over and over. And I look back now on the girl that I was during all those years, and my heart breaks. I was such a mess inside, and I hated who I'd become. I absolutely hated who I'd become. And there were times where I didn't even want to look at myself in the mirror. I was so ashamed. I didn't even know who I was. I felt like a shell of myself, because to actually look at my behaviors, the feelings around that, and to be with it all was entirely too much to bear. I couldn't even fathom it. So I blamed everyone else. I blamed my parents. I especially blamed my boyfriend and tried to change him, never trying to change my behaviors or even look at them. Because if they would act right, I could stop. If they could change, I would feel better. You know, if my boyfriend treated me better, then I wouldn't have to do this. And at the same time, vulnerability was such a foreign concept. There was probably a point in my life where I would rather die than be vulnerable. And vulnerability was the exact thing that I actually needed. I was thrust into vulnerability really unwillingly when my husband left me it was 06. It was the beginning of 06. And at that point, I had no choice but to look at myself and my behaviors and start to break the walls down that I had created. And trust me, those walls were strong and those walls were high, and I did not want them to come down. But when my life fell apart, I picked myself up and started my conscious journey. I hadn't ever truly taken care of myself, and people kept telling me I needed to take care of myself. And I mean, not mentally, physically, emotionally, financially, had I ever truly been there for me. And what I realized is that I had no idea what that meant, to love myself, to even be with myself. I was fucking terrified. I was so scared. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what I stood for. I didn't know what I wanted. I didn't know any of it. I felt like before that I had just existed and existed in this life of these automatic behaviors that were so incredibly painful, but I knew no other way of being. So I just continued that way. And when everything was falling apart, I also didn't realize how tired I had become of people telling me I was strong. And I knew that I knew that they meant well. And I knew that everyone was probably so uncomfortable themselves with my situation and not knowing what to say. But what I really wanted, and this goes back to vulnerability and really empathy, was that I wanted for someone to say, hey, things are a mess and you're probably feeling like shit and it's okay if you're falling apart. Just fall apart and I'll be here to pick up the pieces with you if that's what you want. And again, it's not anyone's fault that they didn't know, because I made it my first priority to make people think I was okay and that I was strong. I guess I did a pretty good job. But the price of that was keeping myself hidden, was keeping myself small, was buying into the beliefs that I wasn't worthy of being anything more than a hot mess. So it took lots of therapy, coaching, a few 12-step programs, several failed relationships and friendships. It took some hard conversations with my parents. It took me getting sober. It took me learning to set boundaries and learning how to be in a healthy relationship and have healthy adult conversations. And two of the hardest things in all of that, that I have had to learn as I came out of that decade and as I healed, was learning to feel my feelings as they are and surrendering to them and surrendering to life and letting it, letting life unfold as it does. I mean, those were really the two things that were really, I don't know if I want to use the word solution, but really it has been like those are the main things, because I like to hold on. I like to be in charge of what's happening in my life. I like to know how it's going to turn out. And I especially like it to go my way, but shit, that's not how life works. Like ever. I've fought the good fight though. I definitely have fought the good fight, and the whole like feeling feelings. There are still times that I want to just check out when I tell myself I can't deal with this. And the truth is, yes, I can. I can deal with it without hiding at the bottom of a bottle of wine. I can deal with it without distracting myself by chasing down a new relationship. And it's hard, and I cry, and I get angry and frustrated and scared, and that is life. That's life. That's what it looks like. And the upside is that I can tell you that happiness and joy is unlike it's ever been. I feel joy deep down in my bones and in my cells. And that can also be really, really scary sometimes. But I feel happy and grateful most of the time in my life. And for me, I know I needed to like go through the weeds and the muck and all that shit to get here. I wouldn't trade it for anything ever. If you have my book, you might see in the acknowledgments that the very end of my acknowledgments, I thanked my ex-husband and told him that he was the catalyst for this. And, you know, he didn't help me. I don't even talk to him, but he didn't help me go through all this recovery. But that happening to me was really, it served a purpose and kind of cannonballed me into living a conscious life and going after what I think that I was really meant to do on this earth. And that is be of service on a larger scale for people that have gone through a path that is similar to mine. They might be different circumstances, but similar behaviors in that hiding and not connecting with other people and not talking about like what's really going on and our fears and all of those things. Like when that's happening, that's lonely and that feels like shit. And I don't want that for you guys. And I guess I want to reiterate that I know how that feels. And if you're going through that right now, I'm sorry. And that sucks. And there is another way. And I wish I could wrap up an answer for you, like really pretty in a bow. But really what it goes back to is learning how to feel your feelings as they are and surrendering to life as it comes. And so I hope that you have, you know, one of the biggest things that I've learned through all of this is having that special someone. And if you have more than one special someone's, and no, I'm not talking about like lots and lots of boyfriends or girlfriends, intimate partners, but that's your thing, you know, whatever. But that compassionate witness, the person that you can turn to and tell them you are extremely scared about something, or that you want to be vulnerable, but you are so scared of what people will think of you. Like all of these things that were the things that we are so afraid to have the world perceive us as, and that's shame is what it is. I hope you have someone to share your shame stories with, because I was, even though I had those people in my life, if I wanted to cultivate those, I was going through all that in my 20s, I was too afraid. I was too afraid I would be judged. I was too afraid that no one would understand. I felt like I was the only person that felt so frustrated and angry. I felt like it was other people's responsibility just to make things better. So I hope you have that person that you can turn to and tell your stories to. And with that, I am going to sign off. I hope that this was helpful for some of you. And please feel free to share this in your communities, and please be gentle with yourselves out there. It's a tough world, but it's not so tough that you can't handle it, because you can. And until next time, I will see you out in cyberspace. Bye-bye.
Hey there, I'm Debbie Reber, the founder of Tilt Parenting and the author of the book Differently Wired. The mission of Tilt is to change the way neurodivergence, whether that's having a learning disability, having ADHD, being gifted, autistic, or some combination of all of the above, is perceived and experienced so differently wired kids and the parents like us raising them can truly thrive. On the Tilt Parenting podcast, I get to talk with authors, therapists, educators, and parenting experts who are committed to this mission. I ask the questions my listeners are most curious about when it comes to supporting our kids. And in turn, my guests share strategies for challenges, out-of-the-box ideas for navigating school, best practices for therapies, tips for advocating, and so many thoughtful insights on what it really takes to help our kids grow up feeling seen and respected so they can create awesome lives for themselves. I know that raising a differently wired kid can feel overwhelming and isolating, but I promise you, you are not alone, and it can feel so much better. If you're on this parenting journey, come listen to Tilt Parenting. Together, we can shift this paradigm and show up for our exceptional kids with hope, possibility, and joy.